it's very difficult to be a whistleblower, especially when thought goes into the decision. The stakes are very high, particularly when the national security is involved. In almost all such cases, the whistleblower faces the prospect of losing friends, of having coworkers turn on him, and even the loss of relationships with family members. But add to that the hostility from the FBI, the CIA, and even the White House. It's one of the most daunting decisions any person could ever make. I'm John Kiriakou, and you're watching The Whistleblowers. Welcome to The Whistleblowers. I'm John Kiriakou. Today, we're going to look at a U.S. national security whistleblower case that is ongoing as we speak. This is the case of Stephen Friend, an FBI agent who recently blew the whistle on an increasingly politicized FBI. For his trouble, the 12-year FBI veteran and member of the FBI's Special Weapons and Tactics Team was stripped of his gun and his badge and escorted out of the building. Let's start this story from the beginning. Stephen Friend did exactly as he was instructed to do when he made a complaint to the FBI Inspector General, saying that the FBI's leadership has become increasingly politicized. He offered proof that the FBI's Washington, D.C. field office was exaggerating the threat of domestic terrorism, even calling parents who complained about educational curricula in their children's schools potential terrorists. He argued that many of the FBI's targets were having their civil rights and civil liberties violated. In the specific incident that led to his whistleblowing, Stephen Friend was ordered to participate in a raid in Daytona Beach, Florida, where the FBI was going to arrest people who were alleged to have committed misdemeanors, minor crimes. He told his leaders that this violated FBI regulations and constituted an illegal use of force. He said that he had taken an oath to uphold the Constitution and that he would not participate in an illegality. That was the end of his career. We are privileged today to have with us FBI whistleblower Stephen Friend. Stephen, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
We're very glad to have you. And I'd like to begin with something that your attorneys have said to the media. In some quarters, you've been wrongly painted as a right-wing extremist. Your attorneys have told the media that your whistleblowing is very simply not a partisan issue. You didn't vote for Donald Trump in the 2020 elections. Instead, you had a genuine concern for protecting the civil rights and civil liberties of Americans. And you took your oath to the Constitution seriously. Was this your calculation that Americans' civil liberties and civil rights were being violated, but nobody was doing anything about it?
Without question, that's I've always kind of said about myself that I'm a centrist and that the Constitution is the only thing that really mattered to me, both from a personal politics standpoint and also just from a professional standpoint. So when I had the opportunity to look into some of the January 6th investigations and realized what we were doing was so out of step with the FBI's rules, it really drew on my heartstrings in that regard, because the due process clause in the Sixth Amendment and the cruel and unusual punishment in the Eighth Amendment, those are in there. And that's what I brought to the attention of my supervisors when I made my disclosures.
Why would the FBI fire you when you made a legally protected whistleblower disclosure just as you were trained to do? You didn't go to the media. You didn't even go to the congressional oversight committees. You didn't have the chance. You went to the FBI Inspector General, which is exactly what you were supposed to do. So why the heavy-handed punishment?
Well, from what I can tell, they disagreed with my assessment of the situation, and they tried to create a situation where they divorced the two aspects of me making my disclosure, which they repeatedly told me was allowed and I could do. But they, from their perspective, said I was refusing to do my job. And they repeatedly said, you're refusing to do your job, right? Is that what you're saying, right? And I always contradicted that and said that my job is to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States. So there was a disagreement in that regard. And when the rubber kind of met the road and it was the unstoppable force meets the immovable object, they had to use the elephant gun to kill the mouse tactic that they like to do when it comes to security clearance.
Right.
So they found ways to suspend my security clearance, because without that clearance, you can't be an FBI agent. So actually, on my suspension document that I got from the FBI's Human Resource Division, I listed a few things, one of which being my refusal to participate in lawful arrests, which was the January 6th, which, again, I didn't refuse to participate in. I said that I had a conflict of interest, conscientious objection, and spoke at length to them about that. Then secondarily, once I was fearful that I was going to be disciplined, I got legal representation, and my attorney asked me to acquire the FBI handbook and some disciplinary procedures for him to mount my defense. So when I did that, they said that I improperly accessed the system that would do that, even though that information is unclassified.
Ridiculous. Many of us like to think that the U.S. government has made great progress on whistleblower protections over the past 15 or 20 years. Congress passed the Whistleblower Protection Act, of course, but unfortunately, national security and federal law enforcement whistleblowers are exempt from its protections. There have been other whistleblowers from the FBI before you, most notably Colleen Rowley, Jane Turner, Fred Whitehurst. What does your case say about the failure of the government to protect its whistleblowers? Why do you think national security whistleblowers still aren't protected?
I think national security, just like a lot of things, it's this huge encompassing force that the FBI and the federal government at large kind of leans on as this get out of jail free card. So, if it's spying on people, or, in my case, if it's sort of just crushing down on a whistleblower for a legitimate concern, they're just always going to lean on that crutch of it's national security. And that's, guided them in their decision making. It's certainly done well for them on the financial side, because the funding for national security is seemingly limitless. And that's just the default perspective that they always are going to have until there's real reform within the whistleblower community.
Stephen, I recently found myself in kind of a strange position where I had been offered what I thought was the job of a lifetime. I accepted that job, and within weeks, I realized that the company's leadership was engaging in fraud and money laundering. So I resigned, and I took thousands of pages of documents with me on a thumb drive. And then through my attorney, I contacted the FBI here in Washington. We went to the FBI's Washington field office. It was very, very difficult to get a meeting, but I finally got in front of an FBI agent. Just minutes after I began explaining what I had and what I wanted to turn over to the FBI, the FBI agent interrupted me and he said, "No offense, but if this doesn't have the word terrorism attached to it, we're not interested." My attorney and I walked out, and to the best of my knowledge, that company continues to engage in fraud and money laundering. What has happened to the FBI? What is this focus on terrorism? And frankly, who defines terrorism at the FBI?
I think that the focus on terrorism is there's a couple of components to that. Certainly in your case with the financial, in my background, investigating violent crime, I always, when I had interactions with prosecutors and even with FBI agents, anything with dollars and cents and numbers, the immediate assumption is that it's going to be very complicated, very complex, and it's very intimidating to those agents, and they just don't want to take on that challenge. And it's painful for me to admit that, because they're supposed to be representing the premier law enforcement agency, and really the roots of the FBI are in white collar criminal work. And that's why I was an accounting major in college. I was one of the skill sets that was why I was recruited. And I think that after 2001 and 9/11, the wallets were opened up significantly when it came to national security, the FBI and just the intelligence state and military, for that matter, just had this blank check where they had unlimited funds, and certainly in my experience in the government, shrinking anything in government or suggesting that we're going to do away with a particular program is really not the best route if you want to elevate. It's always proposing something new and expanding. And just putting that national security label on the top of that page is just going to get you a lot less roadblocks and, right. and bumps in the road. So I think that's a huge part of it. And then also the FBI works hand in glove with federal prosecutors. And a lot of those folks, you know, are lifetime workers and they're doing the good work, but other ones are just straight ambitious and want to have that high paying defense attorney job, you know, after a few years stint in the US Attorney's Office. And they will flat out say, particularly in large cities, do not bring a case to me unless it hits X amount of threshold. So, you know, in Chicago, unless it's $1 million, we're not touching it. Take it over to the state, take it over to the locals. Well, for Chicago, they're just kind of drowning in homicides. They're not going to be able to, they have to triage what's, you know, threat to life ahead of a financial crime. Mm-hmm. And so what just happens is it just lingers until the statute runs out and it's just never addressed.
You're watching The Whistleblowers. We're going to take a short break and then return to our conversation with FBI whistleblower Stephen Friend. Stay tuned.
Is your media a reflection of reality? In a world transformed, what will make you feel safer? Isolation or community? Are you going the right way or are you being led somewhere? Which direction? What is truth? What is fake? In a world corrupted, you need to descend. So join us in the depths, or remain in the shallows.
The ornavirus cell tree, once it gets into your body, it goes right into your lung and causes inflammation. So that actually often is part of fatal. But the new virus, the Omicron, since early this year, when it's starting circulating, spreading around, what we found is that the virus mostly just infects your upper respiratory tract. It doesn't go into your lungs, so that's why the symptom is relatively minor and mild, and usually does not cause severe diseases. So this is something actually we still do not fully understand how the virus evolved and why it actually so much compromised its disease causing ability.
In 1834, France invaded Algeria, and straight away the French started inhabiting it to strengthen their position. The colonists, known as Pieds Noirs, took the best land. From day one, the local population was put into an unequal position and was brutally exploited. This caused mass discontent. The people of Algeria began their long-term fight for independence. In 1954, the banner of freedom was raised by the National Liberation Front. A guerrilla war against the occupants broke out. The French tried to suppress the rebellion using cruel measures. Whole villages were wiped out. Acts of torture and executions of civil people, including pregnant women, children, and old people, took place. More than 2 million people were put into concentration camps. However, these punitive measures didn't help. The Algerian patriots managed to induce France to start peace negotiations. In 1962, Evian Accords were signed, putting Algeria on the path towards independence. But this was achieved at a colossal price. Algeria, by rights, is considered to be a country of martyrs. According to the calculations of historians, the French colonists are responsible for the deaths of 1.5 million Algerians.
Welcome back to The Whistleblowers. I'm John Kiriakou. We're speaking with FBI whistleblower Stephen Friend, who complained about the politicization of the FBI and the FBI's lack of respect for Americans' civil rights and civil liberties. The case isn't over, but so far it looks like he's paid, frankly, for his honesty with his job. We're going to talk about that. Welcome back, Stephen.
Hey, John. Thank you.
Stephen, let's drill down a little bit into what you've revealed. You said that you were a member of the FBI squad that investigated and targeted pedophiles and sex traffickers, but you were taken off that assignment and made to investigate people who had participated in the protest at the Capitol building on January 6, 2021. I'm not talking about rioters necessarily. You were told to investigate, in some cases perhaps arrest, people who had participated peacefully. You told your supervisor on two separate occasions that you had a moral and ethical problem with this. You believed that the FBI was violating demonstrators' Sixth and Eighth Amendment rights. You told your supervisors that your previous work against pedophiles and sex traffickers was, of course, more important. And so you were fired, or at least suspended. Is there a broader message here that we should take from this? What is the message that you think this action conveys to the rest of the FBI workforce?
Well, I think that, you know, like any large organization, it has to develop its priorities. So, you know, with, when it came to me, personally, I felt really strongly about the importance of doing a child pornography investigation work.
Right.
But I ultimately told them that I am a team player and I'm not going to, you know, say I'm refusing to do this work. And I was assigned the top line to work domestic terrorism. So when I was rolled into that, it got a little more familiar. It was my understanding that most of that was January 6th. It wasn't specifically January 6th, but it was kind of this unspoken thing. But I think to the writ large FBI workforce, you're really just not taken seriously. You're just a number for executive management. You know, they're kind of plugging holes. They're moving chess pieces around the board really without regard for any particular skill set or passion or anything. And that's part of the job. And that was something I was willing to accept. And I certainly wasn't going to refuse to do the work. My problem was it has to be done the right way. And if the FBI is going to be operating outside of its rules, you know, whatever the motivations for that are, and I have my own, theories on why they were operating outside the domestic investigations operations guide. If you call them on that, they're going to be really quick to turn on you and find any way that they can to, you know, suppress that information from coming out and really just removing you from being an impediment to whatever their agenda is.
Absolutely. I went through the same thing after I revealed the CIA's torture program. I'm interested to know what the reaction from your colleagues has been. When I blew the whistle on the CIA's torture program way back in 2007, I was very pleasantly surprised by the number of my former colleagues who reached out to me to express support. They couldn't do that publicly, of course, but the fact that they got in touch was a source of strength for me. How has it been with you? Have you found yourself with the support of your friends and colleagues?
It's been a mixed bag. I've had a lot of retired special agents who I never worked with or knew. They reached out through mutual friends and not just through social media. That's one of the few positive things I think social media provides. So I had a huge outpouring of support from them, and then they've really invited me into a lot of their inner circles. I've become familiar with Kyle Serafin, who's the other FBI whistleblower, and he's introduced me to others. But for, you know, the exception of a couple of agents that I considered friends in the FBI, it's been radio silence from them. It's been pretty disheartening. I've said this a couple times. When I came forward and I knew this was going to be a difficult fight, I ultimately knew that I was putting my career on the line and just had accepted that. And I had this image in my head that I was going to be, you know, Captain America at the end of Avengers Endgame, and I was going to be bruised and beaten. And then just when all hope was lost, I would hear "on your left," and I would look over and there would be all these men and women of the FBI, the rank and file at my side. And that's just not come to happen. And it's unfortunate to me. It made me disillusioned about the FBI.
Sure. But you can sleep at night. Stephen, what are the next steps for you? You are out there giving interviews. We're very grateful for this one. I've seen that you're active on LinkedIn. You're looking for work. It's clear to me that you understand that this is going to be a process. It's going to take some time. So in the meantime, what are you looking to accomplish? Do you want to go back to the FBI, or do you want an admission from the FBI that you've been wronged? And also, do you have congressional support? Senators Chuck Grassley, Ron Johnson, Ron Wyden are generally very good on federal whistleblower issues. Are they being helpful?
Yes, in the immediate aftermath, Senator Grassley and Johnson, their staffs were very supportive. They issued a letter to the Attorney General and to the FBI Director on my behalf and asking some very specific and pointed questions and then insisting that I be reinstated. That's fallen on deaf ears. It wasn't surprising to me. Being in the FBI was really my dream job. I really loved the work. I always wanted to do it. And having that opportunity for the 8 years was, you know, really a dream come true. Just coming home every night and having my two young sons just be my ultimate fan club was living my best life. I am pragmatic and realistic. I know that going back at this point is going to be extremely difficult. And really, you know, I'm not in a position of power to negotiate, you know, for them to bring me back. But, you know, if in a perfect world, in a vacuum, if certain reforms were made, I could see myself doing that. Mm-hmm. But I ultimately don't see that coming to pass. So in the meantime, I'm just going to speak out as much as I can to make sure this information reaches the widest possible audience, because I do think it's very important. And regardless of, you know, who you pulled the lever for a week ago, you're an American citizen and you need to know what your government is doing. So that's my goal from the whistleblowing standpoint, and that's why I'm speaking to the media directly about my complaint. And professionally, yeah, I have I had this dormant LinkedIn account that my wife kind of made more active, so I could hope to obtain new employment, because you know she was actually laid off shortly after my suspension came down. Again, have my own suspicions about the nature of that. So we're both, you know, at a point, two young kids in our later 30s and going to have some career changes. So, you know, just put my resume out, and anybody who wants somebody who's going to always talk, you know, shoot straight with you and demonstrate some integrity, I think that's a pretty good resume enhancer for me. And I'm hopeful that maybe somebody will reach out.
We've seen news in the major media outlets, CNN, Fox, Politico, The Hill, it's all over Washington, that there are at least a dozen other FBI agents who have gone to speak to Senator Ron Johnson's staff or the staff of Representative Jim Jordan of Ohio, who's going to take over the House, the chairmanship of the House Investigations Committee. Are we talking about the same kind of information that these other whistleblowers are going to Capitol Hill to discuss, or is this something that's separate?
From what I understand, we are, as a wide variety, it's not necessarily tied to January 6th. You know, I've talked to a couple of them. One is with pertaining to the use of social media, specifically Facebook, and spying on individuals and giving that information over to the FBI. And you know, others have concerned the labeling of parents at school board meetings. So it's really a cornucopia of issues. I think it's just, and that's ultimately why I thought a lot more people would come forward once I did. You know, I thought the dam was eventually going to break. It seems that they've kind of sealed it up a little bit more for now, but I'm hopeful that with the changeover, at least on the gavel in January to Congressman Jordan, and he's going to want to go after these issues a little more aggressively, that maybe we'll see that there's a little bit of a cavalry there to support us. And also support for whistleblowers legally. You know, I've worked with the Empower Oversight. I was really fortunate. Congressman Jordan's office attached me to Jason Foster at Empower Oversight. And without that, I really would have been hung out to dry. So, you know, something like that becomes more publicly knowledgeable. I think folks will feel a little bit more comfortable about bringing information forward, regardless if it's January 6th or anything else.
Right. Let me ask you actually a follow-up about that. After I blew the whistle on the torture program back in 2007, I did a lot on Capitol Hill that the media didn't cover, the media didn't know about. I was asked to testify privately before the Senate Armed Services Committee, for example. I went over to the House side to talk to the House Intelligence Committee. Are you getting these kinds of requests from staff members, the people who make Capitol Hill run on a day-to-day basis? Do they want to know the background to this case, the kinds of things that would go into a proper Capitol Hill investigation?
So I talked to the staff for both Senator Johnson and Grassley, and that information was compiled into their letter. I've talked multiple times with Congressman Jordan's staff, and I believe that the information I provided to them was tied to his 1,000-page report. So, and since the Senate's not going to change hands, I don't expect to have any in committee requests next year from that side. I would welcome it. I really want them to look into this, but I'm also realistic. I think Congressman Jordan will probably try to bring that to a head, but he's also got a multiple number of issues that he's going to be looking into. So I'm hoping to participate in that. I'm hoping to work with those staffs. Certainly when I have talked to them, they've been really receptive. But right now, not too much interaction with the Congress. Obviously, they were working on their elections, so I think they all got a little bit sidetracked.
Right.
As far as media, I basically have agreed to speak with anybody who would like to. It's really been mostly conservative media that has reached out to me. I was fortunate that Matt Taibbi came in and did a long form interview with me and is doing a multiple piece exposure of some of the problems within the FBI. And he released that last week. And he's certainly somebody at the left. I talked with Jane Turner on her podcast, and I think she probably leans left as well. So again, the politics of the situation don't matter to me. It's just that I'm really concerned about an audience, across the board having this information at their fingertips because it's important.
It is important. You're doing the right thing. What can the rest of us do to help you and other whistleblowers or to help and encourage others considering becoming whistleblowers? This is a long and very difficult road. What advice would you give them to make the experience a little bit easier?
I kind of came into this totally fresh. I didn't know the process. And certainly the agencies are not going to make that process very readily available because they don't want problems coming into light so easily. So, as I've learned more, I've been trying to extend that information to others so that, if they do decide to do it, they do it the right way, the right process, and they don't get themselves and, caught up in anything. Me personally, I've just continued to hammer this message home. Like you said, I'm just going to keep talking because I know I have the facts and the Constitution on my side and the law on my side. So no need to hammer the table when you have the facts and you have the law. And then also just career opportunities. And that's really the scariest thing. My wife and I, we were scared. We know we did the right thing. I would never for a second have done anything different. It didn't occur to me that I had any other options other than to do the job that that was in front of me, which was to protect the Constitution. So at this point, it's a little bit of a stress on us. We do have a great family network, and certainly a lot of folks have been charitable and offered to support us. But I'm not looking for a handout. I just am somebody who wants to do an honest day's work, and I've had a couple reach out, and I'm hoping that we have some more because the more opportunities I get, the better for us. And we're pretty well entrenched where we are, but we're definitely open to relocating if need be.
Fantastic. I want to thank our guest, Stephen Friend, and I want to wish him well in this experience. And thank you to our viewers for joining us. Whistleblowing is a tough decision. The truth teller's life changes forever, and rarely for the better. But there's a bigger issue at play here. It's the issue of honesty and integrity. Author William Faulkner once said, "Never be afraid to raise your voice for honesty and truth and compassion against injustice and lying and greed. If people all over the world would do this, it would change the earth." Those are words to live by. You've been watching The Whistleblowers. I'm John Kiriakou. Until next time.